Yo, what's up, guys? I am Michael, and this is Off the Top Dope, where we take a look back at some of the most and least dope moments in professional wrestling history. So without further delay, let's get into it. Today, we are talking the top 10 most shameless gimmicks. Yo,
Off the Top Dope.
So kayfabe died a long time ago. The curtain was pulled back, and we all have come to know over time that these personalities, these people we see performing on the screen, are just the brain children of promoters, bookers, and even sometimes the wrestlers themselves. And in most ways, it's on the wrestler themselves to make the gimmick work and really put it over for the crowd and, you know, get a reaction. But sometimes creative just has like fucking nothing for these guys. And if they have something, it's pretty shitty. And that's what we're talking about today. So let's get into it. The shitty underbelly of wrestling gimmicks.
Number 10.
April 1996 saw the beginning of what was undoubtedly one of the biggest buildups in wrestling history. I'm talking several months worth of vignettes leading up to this. We saw a dark screen with blue snow falling as some ancient symbol begins to unlock itself to reveal a blinding light. The screen begins to freeze over. The words, "Our world is about to change," glow brightly, followed by the menacing phrase, "Blood runs cold," coming to WCW. Now, can you take a guess who cracks the list in our first spot? I'm talking about Mortal Kombat's own Sub-Zero. Wait, no, that's not right. I'm talking about WCW's Glacier. And these vignettes went on for like 5 months, guys. I mean, people were getting pretty hyped. They like had no idea like what this could mean. And it took a few months for it to finally say Glacier. Like at first it just said that bit. So no one really knew like what this could mean. I mean, Glacier was originally set to debut in July of 1996, but due to the monumental impact of the NWO's formation at Bash at the Beach, his debut was pushed back all the way to September. But don't think for a second that WCW let up on the vignettes promising our world was about to change. When Glacier finally debuted on the September 9th episode of WCW Pro, they pulled out all the stops for this guy. I mean, they spent nearly $500,000 on producing his entrance with fake snow, strobe lights, music, and bright-ass blue lasers. And on top of that, they spent $35,000 on his ring and entrance attires. I mean, you might remember that helmet and that shield or whatever. And that's, you know, that stuff alone, that's about $70,000 today. All for a guy that looked like WCW should have been praying they wouldn't get a letter from Midway Games about. I just can't imagine being given that big of a push and then having to stand there for the big reveal looking like that, though. I mean, you might think it was cool, but I mean, it's just kind of, I don't know. But I mean, don't get it twisted, Glacier was more than just a look. I mean, WCW Magazine featured a profile on him in the October 1996 issue, which basically let us know that he had actually traveled to Japan to study an ancient fighting style that mixed martial arts with professional wrestling, and all his expertise was gained under the tutelage of Sensei David Stater. Sensei David.
Are you fucking kidding me?
But wouldn't you know it though, despite going undefeated for the entire first year of his career, he remained in the middle of the card for the entirety of his stay at WCW. He must have made Sensei Dave so proud. Honestly though, I'm not shitting on him. I mean, he was a pretty good wrestler, but that gimmick, dude.
Number 9.
What can really be said about our next wrestler? The guy only had one match that was televised, and the gimmick was immediately dropped. I mean, if you missed it, you didn't miss much. I'm talking about Fantasio. Debuting and retiring on the July 16th, 1995 episode of WWF's Wrestling Challenge, Fantasio defeated Tony DeVito of ECW's DeBaldi's and ROH's Carnage Crew fame. And while it definitely had to suck for DeVito to lose to Fantasio, imagine having to actually be Fantasio. He was a quote-unquote magician wrestler, and he came to the ring wearing a black and white mime mask, which he then removed to reveal the exact same design painted on his actual face. He then gave the mask to a kid at ringside who threw it on the floor and gave Fantasio the finger. I mean, that part didn't actually happen, but it really should have. So as I mentioned, he defeated Tony DeVito, but can you guess how? Maybe he had some magical finisher, like a moonsault, or some brand new signature move we've never seen before. Maybe Fantasia was booked to blow our minds and force us to question, is magic real? But instead, Fantasia pulled DeVito's boxers up out of his ring gear and one with a cheap roll-up. Then just when you think you've seen it all, he does the exact same thing to Earl Hebner, who just happened to be wearing referee-striped boxers. You just can't make this up. They should have just shut the whole company down if this was the kind of shit Creative was churning out in 1995. Like I said, Fantasia only had one televised match and then the gimmick was dropped, but the only magic trick this gimmick achieved was getting greenlit in the first place. Number 8. 2 years before Ted Turner bought Jim Crockett Promotions and founded WCW in 1988, he purchased MGM for $1.5 billion fucking dollars, and though he ended up selling a lot of it right back to the person he bought it from just a few months later, he had the forethought to keep the film library. He had the rights to use any character from MGM films made from 1924 to 1986, and according to Jim Cornette, the idea was even floated of finding a one-legged wrestler to be Long John Silver. Can you imagine? But can you imagine having the ability to use characters from that film library and then the one you use is based on the fucking Wizard of Oz? I don't remember Dorothy batting away flying monkeys with chair shots, so it's definitely quite a jump in my mind at least to fit that into the world of professional wrestling. But what do I know? The poor soul that got picked for this gimmick was none other than Kevin Nash. Years before, he was rocking the Winged Eagle Championship as Big Daddy Cool Diesel, or leading the Wolfpack as some cat they call Big Sexy. Kevin Nash was given an additional $50,000 to dress up as number 8 on our list, Oz. Like, the Wizard of Oz. Heading to the ring in a lime green cape featuring shimmering stars and squiggles, with a fluffy matching wizard hat with an old bearded man's latex face sewn to the front, Kevin Nash would unceremoniously throw everything off but his tights, almost like he was sick of all this bullshit. I mean, can you really blame him though? He made short work of his opponents early on in this run, but then eventually started getting jobbed left and right. Not too long after this, Kevin Nash re-debuted as Vinny Vegas, an arguably way better character. Great and powerful my ass. Fuck Oz. Number 7. What gimmick would you guys pick for number 7? Imagine this. October 4th, 1999, we see a vignette of a little boy walking to a window, floating in thin air in the middle of the desert. He approaches it, and through the window, we see the strobing of lightning illuminating a horse. The horse then vanishes, and we see a man in a black trench coat and wide-brimmed hat floating above the trees in a dark night scene. The following week, we see the same boy waking up in the middle of the night to find the same man outside his window, warning of the horrors he was bringing to WCW. I'm talking, of course, about 7. If you've never seen these vignettes, let me paint the picture for you. 7, aka Dustin Rhodes, the voice was recorded using the same effect that they used on the Shockmaster years before, and while the Shockmaster was a monumental failure before it even began, 7 was given a decent push for about a month before debuting. While definitely a unique character, his whole look seemed thrown together, almost like a bald version of The Undertaker. And while it can be a little hard to understand what he was saying in those vignettes, who honestly gives a shit? I mean, this gimmick was fucked from the very beginning. We got about a month of vignettes of a middle-aged man in white clown paint peeking into the same boy's window over and over again. I mean, I get this was supposed to be unsettling, but what the fuck does this have to do with anything? I get not every gimmick is like a super fighter or a brutal brawler, but Dustin Rhodes was seriously being booked as what I could only gather was a horror movie child molester with a horse. And you know, I don't mean to make light of that subject because it's really serious, and I guess 1999 WCW Creative didn't realize that. I mean, we all know Dustin performed as Goldust in the WWF before this, and say what you want about Goldust, but this was really something else. When 7 finally debuted in early November of 1999, he made what was honestly a pretty cool entrance, floating to the ring while fog billowed below him and unsettling music echoed. Once in the ring, Dustin began tearing the gimmick apart and blaming the writers in the back. I can't believe I'm saying this, but Vince Russo did not create this character. It was already in the works before he showed up at WCW. Even more unbelievable is Russo is actually the one who axed this gimmick. Dustin burying the seven character in the ring came from Russo, from all accounts I've heard. This was the start of WCW breaking kayfabe on air, which was endless.
Number six.
So you may remember back in like the late 90s, WCW was throwing a shitload of spaghetti at the wall trying to get anything to stick. They would bring in Megadeth, Insane Clown Posse, The Misfits, just pretty much anything that they thought was popular. They would try to incorporate it some way. And then in 1998, a gimmick was given to Bryan Adams, but he never actually ended up wrestling as the character. It was instead given to Dale Torberg, and it was a joke. It was an absolute joke. I'm talking about the Kiss Demon. Eric Bischoff, for all his wisdom and experience in professional wrestling, was able to negotiate with the band Kiss, arguably one of the biggest bands ever. That's neither here nor there. He was able to negotiate with them to have a character based on Gene Simmons, and eventually there was supposed to be an entire stable called the Warriors of Kiss that was each based on the other band members, like Paul Stanley, and you know who they are, or maybe you don't. Doesn't matter. Dale Torberg and Eric Bischoff are really the only names you need to know in this segment. His debut was kicked off by a concert on Nitro by Kiss, and it ended up being one of the lowest rated segments in the history of Nitro. So obviously the Kiss Demon gimmick was off to a pretty shitty start. Not only that, but he ended up losing to Terry Funk his debut match, which, I mean, really, if he had beaten Terry Funk, that would have been some shit. But in the contract that Kiss had with WCW, the Kiss Demon was guaranteed a main event match, and it was originally supposed to be versus Vampiro at a New Year's Eve 1999 pay-per-view, but that was scrapped because Eric Bischoff was actually let go before this character even debuted. So they were kind of just working off of what they were legally obligated to do because the contract was already signed. So main event match? Sure. Super Brawl 2000. We'll have a special main event match. Fourth match on the card. The Kiss Demon versus The Wall, who proceeded to beat the fuck out of the Kiss Demon, choke slamming him to hell and making this Gene Simmons lookalike look like absolute shit. It's no surprise that when WWF purchased WCW, Torberg elected to just go back to baseball, because, I mean, if this is what the kind of shit that creative assigns you, I mean, it was dead on arrival. I mean, the bookers just wanted to make Bischoff look like absolute shit by booking him in all these shitty matches, having him lose all the time, that special main event. That's just, I don't know. They did what they had to do contractually, legally, but hey, that's how it goes.
Number five.
So we're halfway through the list now, and you might be thinking, hey, I thought some of those weren't really that bad. But here we go. Number five, Arachnaman. WCW Creative in their early to very early mid-90s was just doing a shit fucking job. I mean, Arachnaman. You also had the Gambler, like, but Arachnaman. Brad Armstrong, God rest his soul, was saddled with this shitty gimmick in 1991. This guy would come to the ring. I mean, if you haven't seen it, you need to look it up. This guy, he's wearing a Spider-Man suit, but it's purple and gold instead of blue and red. And he'd come to the ring, he'd stand on the top turnbuckle and throw confetti from his hands like it was webs. And then, like, every single move was pretty much how you would imagine Spider-Man would do it. He would even do like that crouch, that sort of like Spider-Man crouching thing. Every single Arachnaman match I've seen ended with some sort of shitty roll-up, like an abdominal stretch into a roll-up or a victory roll. I mean, Brad Armstrong wasn't a bad wrestler at all, but I mean, he just, this gimmick just wouldn't work for anybody, I can't imagine. It only lasted about 3 months, and then they had to just completely drop it because Marvel was, It's differing. I've read different things. It said that they had sued, that they had filed a lawsuit, or they were threatening legal action. Either way, Marvel was like, yo, you guys cannot do this. And I think WCW probably knew that that would be eventually coming because, I mean, like, what the hell? You had Paul Heyman on ECW playing unlicensed music. You had WCW dressing people up like colorblind Spider-Man. I mean, dude, the 90s were just, it's just really something. You couldn't do that shit now. And I kind of feel for Brad Armstrong because, I mean, he had to be Arachnaman. He had to be BA, which was basically a ripoff of his brother, the Road Dogg, in WWF. Just before Arachnaman, he was the Candyman. It's just, I mean, that poor guy. You know, you get into wrestling, I imagine you get into it thinking, you know, you're gonna, you know, make something of yourself, and then creative just hands you shit. They just shovel shit, and you've got to do it because you're under contract. And, you know, that's really one of the worst parts of wrestling, you know, other than getting injured. But I don't know.
Number four.
October 23rd, 1995, Monday Nitro. The tag team of Sting and Lex Luger took on Harlem Heat in a winning effort, to which the Giant comes out and chokeslams Lex Luger and then Sting. Macho Man runs out, followed by Hulk Hogan, who take out the Giant. And then, on the stage, just before the show cuts away, we see a block of ice explode and a mummy-like figure emerging from the ice. Everyone is wondering what the hell this is, what this could be, and what this could mean. Halloween Havoc is coming up, and I just can't even imagine having watched this live. I wasn't watching yet. I started in 1996. But Halloween Havoc 1995 saw the main event of the Giant and Hulk Hogan. And as unmemorable as the match itself is, at one point, the Giant gets Hulk Hogan into a bear hug, which he has locked in for like 3 minutes. And then suddenly, from the entrance ramp, comes the mummy-like figure that exploded from the ice the last time we saw him. And he makes his way to the ring, and he's just dressed like a mummy. He's like wrapped from head to toe. He had lifts in his boots to make him look super tall, and I read that they wrapped his head up higher than his head really was to make him look super tall. And he's making his way to the ring just looking like a fucking idiot. And then he gets in and he joins the Giant's bear hug. So the Giant is at Hulk Hogan's front. The Yeti, which is his name, grabs him from the back, and they're both bear hugging him, but it looks like the Yeti doesn't even really know what he's doing. He's just kind of shimmying and like shaking all over him to like really sell it, but he's like selling like he's like never even seen wrestling or even seen somebody get hurt before, or like he even knows like anything at all. In the end, the Giant ended up winning. But I mean, who even remembers the match itself or who won? I mean, when you see this stupid ass looking mummy making his way to the ring and Tony Schiavone's on commentary going, "The Yeti! The Yeti!" And then you see this dude fucking shimmying all over Hulk Hogan, like the pay-per-view is just in the trash can at that point. And there, I mean, I get that it was Halloween Havoc, so, you know, a mummy theme, I guess, fits Halloween. But, I mean, there's lots of things that fit the Halloween theme. You could have done something else that would have been way cooler than this. And then after Halloween Havoc, the Yeti, the whole mummy look was just completely dropped. And he was, for some reason, suddenly a masked ninja, which makes absolutely no sense. But, I mean, I guess it's better than a mummy.
Number three.
You know, I just kind of realized that with the exception of Fantasio, these have all been WCW gimmicks. And that's kind of funny because when I look back on WCW, I kind of look back fondly and think that they did a lot of things better than the WWF in the 90s. And now I'm kind of, you know, looking over this list, and I'm like, what the fuck? But nonetheless, number three is a WWE creation debuting in 2004. And if you thought so far these gimmicks weren't really, I guess, shameful, like the title says, I think you definitely are going to want to stick around for the rest of this, because I'm talking about Eugene. He debuted on Raw in April 2004, and he was Eric Bischoff's kayfabe nephew. And from what I've gathered, the character was actually created by Nick Dinsmore, who played Eugene, or I guess performed as Eugene. But apparently he was actually inspired by Eugene Palermo, who was a WWE ring boy that would set up and take down the ring. And the problem with that is Palermo had Down syndrome, so Eugene, the character, was actually based on someone with actual mental disabilities. And if you go look back on it now and you see how the Eugene character was portrayed and how Nick Dinsmore acted, it's actually pretty shitty to see that he's doing sort of like the, stereotypical imitation that's just kind of all around fucked and offensive. I mean, imagine if you were watching Raw with like your child who had learning disabilities, and then you see this character debut who's just acting completely over the top, like of just a ridiculous, I can't even think of how to say it, but you know what I mean. I mean, the character was portrayed as a great in-ring performer. I mean, he would imitate wrestlers that he had seen on TV. He would, steal finishers, and it was probably something that was fun for Nick Dinsmore, to be able to do these finishers and get huge pops. And the crowd was really behind him, but I feel like for the wrong reasons. And think of all the times that like Eugene was just like, naively manipulated and humiliated by those around him. And it just paints just an all around bad picture. Like this, I mean, these are things, that potentially people with learning disabilities could actually encounter. And here the WWE is putting it on as a show to sell tickets and move some merchandise. And I've seen, people say that it's, like an underdog story, against all odds, he's, rising and achieving, trying to achieve his dreams or whatever. But that's what half the storylines in wrestling are. So, I mean, do we really need to do this one? Like, we really needed to go this route? I mean, to me, it just made fun of people with disabilities. It made a lot of the wrestlers look bad who had negative interactions with him in storyline. He had matches with like a lot of top tier talent where he actually won. And for what? I mean, like, what did this do at the end of the day other than sell tickets? I don't know. That's just my opinion. And, if maybe you disagree, but hey, microphones are cheap. Start your own podcast.
Number two.
So the origins of this next one are a little confusing, but basically we've got Super Crazy, Psychosis, and Juventud Guerrera in a stable together. The three of them were all coming into WWE together at the same time, and Vince McMahon wanted to make them a group, and they're all kind of standing there trying to come up with a name. And Juventud Guerrera, I guess, was like, oh, it should be something cool. And then he's like, how about Mexicools? And Vince McMahon, I guess, ate that shit up. And I guess from there, the gimmick just became something that Juventud Guerrera said that he hated. I don't know what he had in mind or what they had said it was going to be. But in the end, the group ended up being three Mexican wrestlers just shoveling shit on Mexican Americans and just using all these stereotypes. It was them riding to the ring on lawnmowers that they called Mexican limousine. I mean, lawnmowers? Are you kidding me? Like, you may disagree, but in my book, Juventud Guerrera is one of the best luchadors out there, and I don't think he needed this stereotypical bullshit to get over. I mean, probably one of the only really good points that they made in their promos was the lack of Mexican luchadors in WWE's cruiserweight division, which was true, because, I mean, you look back at WCW's cruiserweight division, because WWF didn't have one at that time. But you had like Rey Mysterio, Juventud, Psychosis, La Parca, all these guys. So like I agree with the sentiment of like the lack of representation, but the whole gimmick being about, you know, Mexican immigrants being like gardeners and doing like, you know, all these day labor jobs was just shitty. Like, it's kind of like the same thing with Eugene. Like, the storyline was just relying on preconceived notions of what certain people are like. And it really didn't last that long either, because due to backstage problems, Juventud Guerrero was released. And then after that, Super Crazy and Psychosis were getting into kayfabe fights with each other. And the group just split up. And, you know, I don't know much about Super Crazy, to be honest with you, but having followed Psychosis and Juventud Guerrero's careers, it just seems kind of like a low point for some super talented wrestlers. Number one. In the weeks leading up to the 1990 Survivor Series, the WWF started really pushing this small stage that they had that featured a giant egg atop it, and there were question marks on the stage and the Survivor Series logo, and people started to really question like what this could be. They started speculating. Mean Gene would invite kids up to check the egg out, and he would ask them what they thought it could be. Some kid said a dinosaur, another said balloons, one said a rabbit. But a lot of the adult fans, believe it or not, actually thought that inside the egg was former world champion Ric Flair returning to the WWF. Because, you know, when you see an egg, the first thing you think is the nature boy Ric Flair. I've got a carton with 12 grade A natures in the fridge right now. And this whole egg thing wasn't even just a sideshow thing. This was actually used to build Survivor Series. They were promising that the egg would open at Survivor Series. This was used to push ticket sales and pay-per-view buys. And it was sort of like a semi-main event thing at Survivor Series. And when the time finally came, Mean Gene was right next to the stage cutting a promo, saying, oh, well, it's heating up in here, and he started relating that to the incubation for the egg and stuff. It was just ridiculous, and he's listening to the egg, and he's like, oh, that cracks me up. I mean, we all miss you, Mean Gene, but what the hell? Also, I forgot to mention that he had also speculated that it could be the playmate of the month in the egg, which got a pretty decent pop from some lower registered voices, obviously men in the audience. So the moment finally comes where the egg starts cracking and Mean Gene starts selling the fuck out of this. Like, this is a huge moment in wrestling, and the egg starts cracking away, and then all of a sudden we see this guy in a turkey costume pop out, and the crowd just immediately starts booing. They're just like, is this a joke? The turkey gets down, Mean Gene starts interviewing it, and of course it's just gobbling. And Mean Gene's trying to pretty much work with this. He's like, oh, gobbledygooker, are you kidding me? And he's like, well, I guess it's Thanksgiving. What can you expect? So the gobbledygooker is his name, and he's a fucking turkey mascot. So he pulls Mean Gene to the ring. They start dancing, doing a little hoedown. The gobbledygooker does a cartwheel. Mean Gene follows in suit, nails a cartwheel barely, and dies in the ring. Then, surprisingly, the gobbledygooker goes out on the ring apron and nails a fucking buckshot lariat, Adam Page style, and then lands in a front roll. I mean, that was pretty impressive. I mean, he was portrayed by Hector Guerrero, a legit professional wrestler, but, I mean, I don't think anybody was really expecting anything other than a stupid-ass mascot at this point when they saw that fucking turkey come out. But, all in all, the performance was entertaining for the crowd, but I think people were just kind of like, what the fuck is this? The gobbledygooker was intended to be like a kid-friendly mascot, because remember, this was back when they weren't really even, you know, brawling outside the ring. There was really no adult-themed storylines or anything like that. No swearing at all. I mean, that's really never been a big thing in WWE. But it's actually believed that the inspiration for the gobbledygooker came from this mascot for the it was called the San Diego Chicken, and it was a sports mascot and like a TV and radio mascot. He would just show up at random places, and it was a, you know, a chicken costume. But in 1979, to sort of reveal the new colors of the costume, you know, his new feathers, he rehatched from an egg, similarly to how the gobbledygooker did. So, I mean, you can definitely say that's where they got that from. All in all, the gobbledygooker made a few more appearances, but unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, his last appearance was at Madison Square Garden when he went to do that Buckshot Lariat style entrance into the ring I was talking about. But they had the lights way down in Madison Square Garden and they had just a spotlight on him and he really couldn't see in that costume at all. So all he could see was just a white light. So he did, you know, nails the buckshot, falls right on his ass, gets up and he's trying to play it off like it's just a joke or whatever. But then when Hector got to the back, Vince McMahon just walked away. He was just not impressed at all. And then he was basically just pushed out of the company. He did make another appearance later on at WrestleMania 17 as the Gobbledygooker because they had a sort of like a rumble sort of match where they had stars of the past competing and the Gobbledygooker came out. And he was obviously one of the first people eliminated because you can't have the Gobbledygooker win. Or can you? Because they had the character come back years later and he pinned R-Truth and became the 24/7 champion, which is just kind of ridiculous. But I mean, the WWE at this point, they knew it was a joke. It wasn't like in 1990 when they brought it out as like a real thing that they were pursuing, you know, that they wanted to do. So it was, the tone was different. So to the gobbledygooker of the later days when he came back, that's okay with me, but like the original one, it's like, what the fuck were you guys thinking? Like, how are you gonna have a mascot, like a Thanksgiving mascot year round? That just doesn't make sense. And that's apparently what they were going for, was that was supposed to be like a mascot for the WWF, a fucking turkey, which is why that was number one on our list. So thank you guys for checking this out. More episodes to come. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. If you're listening on Spotify, you know, just let me know. There should be like a comment field below this. Just let me know what you thought, what you think needs improvement or whatever. And I definitely appreciate any input. But until then, just keep enjoying wrestling, guys, because it's the dopest fucking sport on the planet. Take it easy.